Thank you. May it please the court. I wanted to say, the first thing I want to say is that if it weren't for my friend, the Attorney General, I wouldn't even be here because somehow my computer, I'll blame the computer, lost the link. And I emailed her at 9 o'clock last night saying, help, help. And she sent me the link.
Well, we appreciate collegiality between counsel. So congratulations.
Well, it was more than that, too, because when you pointed out correctly that there were some things that should have been in the excerpt of record, she did it all. So there. Okay. So I have to get that. I had to say that first. And then launching into this, Judge Smith, I can't forget the last time I was actually orally arguing in front of you. It was a couple of years ago. And it involved, you know, this is a strange way to approach oral argument, talking about the whole case. But I have to do it because this may be a similar situation where you did my work for me. It was the case where the individual had all his materials taken away from his cell and he couldn't file his petition timely. And I missed that. There's small print that says, wait a minute, he could have had several cubic feet. And your staff saw that, and I didn't. And you pointed that out to me in oral argument, and I ended up sitting down quickly. Because and somehow, you know, in this kind of work, there's this wonderful quote from Samuel Johnson. I bet that name is familiar to you. He was a great writer in the 1700s.
Yeah, Judge Clifton and I knew him well.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, I know him because his words actually motivate just about everything I do, and especially this quote, "The sight of the gallows focuses the mind wonderfully." And oral argument is, in a way, the sight of the gallows, and there's a different focus when it gets close to oral argument, and I see things that maybe I didn't see before. And of course, in that case where I argued, I never did see it till you pointed it out. But I realized that the declaration of Peter Kergel, which the AG got in the magistrate's court, really does help me. And I see it because all I had to prove was that there was a latent print on that bottle. Now, Mr. Kergel, he told me that back in 2015. And I put that in my declaration. There's a print. And the prosecutor, who is sadly deceased now, I couldn't ever reach him. And the trial attorney, they're both gone. They're both not on the planet. And so there was a little difficulty, a lot of difficulty in there because I couldn't communicate with them. And that's really all I needed I should have. My point is the Supreme Court of California should have granted my an order to show cause because there was a print and the prosecutor said and his investigator told the jury there wasn't.
And well, let me ask you this. Since we go way back and are friends and everything like that, let me be candid with you here.
All right.
You got a situation here that's a little bit different. Yes, there was a print, but as you well know, as a very experienced lawyer, there are prints and there are prints. In this case, the evidence showed that your client was wearing gloves, so there wouldn't be any prints. You also don't know if there were prints, whose prints they were. There could have been any number of things, from a delivery man to the beer to somebody else in the household. You don't know. But the reality is it's not at all clear that it would have matched or not matched your clients, even if it were, able to, they could determine it. And as you know, materiality and how much it would affect the verdict is what counts here, especially under AEDPA. So as an expert in AEDPA, will you tell me, please, given what we've got with this, the nature of this print, why this should make a difference, why it should help your client?
Okay, I will focus on that. I will focus on that. The gloves. I'm focusing on the gloves. The poor victim in this case, and she was a victim, said that he washed his face in the sink during this. You don't wash your face with gloves on. The gloves came off, and that's in the record.
And at what point did he wash his face, before or after the I'll call them anal insults?
Right. Well, you know, that's hard to that's really hard to pin down, because there he stayed around. He didn't, you know, it was a crazy situation. I remember the police came and there were flashing lights outside and he saw them, this intruder. I can't answer that question directly, and I think it's only speculation.
Given that fact, and given your expertise in AEDPA, your client, I believe, has the burden to show that no fair-minded jurist could conclude what was concluded by the California Courts of Appeal and the District Court and the like. Isn't that correct?
Okay, I'll focus on that now. I focused on the gloves. Now I'll get to AEDPA. And I don't want to run out of time, and I'm getting there fast.
How much do you want to save? How much time?
Oh, gosh, at least 2 minutes.
Okay, I'll try to help you.
Thank you. But here's the point. It was when I filed my habeas, and it was a petition for review from a summary denial under People versus Duval, the Supreme Court of California had to assume everything I said was true. See, that's the whole thing. And they saw a problem, and they asked for that. Whenever the Supreme Court asks you and your opponent for more, you know you're on the A-list. You know what I mean? In other words, they said, uh-oh, there's something here. We better get some more from both counsel. And I got that. And that's in the thanks to my friend, the Attorney General, that is in your excerpt of record. It wasn't before, and that was really on me. But my answer has everything in it. The answer that I replied to the state attorney general in my petition for review, they had to grant. It was unreasonable, to use those magic words. That's what it was, unreasonable for the Supreme Court not to grant an order to show cause, because I proved that there was a print, and that the district attorney said to the jury, there's no print. He called out the deceased defense attorney, and his investigator told the jury, there's no print.
But what you did not prove was that information had been withheld from your client's counsel at the time, because you're the one that came up with the card. And this thing's stored by your client.
Well, he was dying during the trial.
You're not answering my question. Telling me what establishes that the information on the card, which your client possessed, hadn't been turned over to counsel previously.
Okay, can
it
I
must
answer
have
that?
Been.
I'll try to answer that. He would, if he had that card, he would have screamed bloody murder when the prosecutor said there was no print. He said, wait a minute.
At some point, he got the card.
Wait a minute.
He had to have gotten the card because your client had it.
That's all speculation, Your Honor.
No, it's not. You're the one that found the card. How did you find the card? It was in your client's possession.
It was in a box, and there were multiple attorneys in this. You understand, it was not in my client's possession. My client was in custody. He never had possession of that. So you can't say that, Judge Clifton. It was not in my client's
possession. If it wasn't his possession, it was his counsel's possession. And it's going to be your burden to tell us why it was. We should infer from that it had not been turned over at the appropriate time.
Because it's incomprehensible that this attorney would have ignored it during that trial. That was his defense, that there was another print that could not be traced to his client. His whole defense was Soddy, right? S-O-D-D-I, some other dude did it.
Well, his whole defense may be unsuccessful, too, and might be a lie. I mean, there are lots of alternatives. So to tell me it's incomprehensible really doesn't tell me why this proves that it had not been disclosed to counsel on a timely basis.
Judge Clifton, I'm running out of time, and all I'll show you.
Out of time. Why don't we do this? Let's hear from the Attorney General, and out of the goodness of our hearts, we're going to give you a minute to respond.
I appreciate
after the Attorney General tells us what her version of this is.
Thank you.
So let's hear from the Attorney General, and to whom we owe our debt of gratitude for being such a collegial colleague.
Well, good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Blythe Leske, for respondent. May it please the court. I don't have the pleasure of knowing any of you personally, but hopefully will at some point in the future. The fingerprint evidence in this case was not suppressed. It was not exculpatory. It was not material. And there was no false evidence presented in this case. The California Court of Appeals rejection of petitioner's Brady claim was reasonable because it fails on every element. First, it was not suppressed. We know that, as Judge Clifton mentioned, it was found located by counsel in petitioner's file. Whether it was petitioner's personal file, was in his sister's garage. The only way he could have gotten it is from his attorneys. That fact alone defeats his claim. But we also know from the record that this evidence was discussed in court. It was discussed pre-trial and discovery. There was a discovery compliance hearing that was taken off calendar, which of course suggests that discovery was complied with. And it was discussed in testimony. Counsel was very much aware of this evidence, and there's no way on a case where your defense is identity that he would have gone to trial without receiving this evidence. It was also not exculpatory. The intruder in this case wore gloves. That fact was undisputed at trial and at every point. Therefore, any print that may have been found was necessarily not the attacker's. Additionally, the beer bottle was taken from the victim's home. We're talking about a weapon that was almost certainly touched by the victim herself, could have been touched by other people in the household. She obviously would have bought it from a store where it could have been touched at any point by dozens of people along its road to getting to where it was used as the weapon.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course, Your Honor.
Didn't the victim affirmatively identify her assailant at the scene and in open court?
Yes.
Well, then, yes. Isn't your best argument that none of this makes a bit of difference?
Yes, and that is exactly where I was getting to, so thank you. It was completely immaterial. We have extraordinarily strong identification evidence in this case from the victim, who was the perpetrator's wife of over 16 years. We're not talking about a stranger identification in this case. Her identification was detailed, it was consistent through trial, and it was corroborated. She saw him, of course, during the perpetration of this crime, or actually afterwards when he removed his mask and she saw him in the mirror. And just talking about that point in the crime for a moment, and responding to counsel's argument that there's no evidence and there's no reason that the perpetrator would have had to take off his gloves when he went into the bathroom to rinse his face because he was sweating profusely. He was wearing rubber latex gloves. And one would assume that somebody who goes to the point trouble of wearing gloves to prevent fingerprints would have left those gloves on, wouldn't have needed to take them off to splash his face. And in any event, that occurred after the attack at issue here with the bottle. The victim's identification was extremely detailed. As I said, she recognized even the second he burst in through the door, she said she knew it was him because he had done that sort of thing before. She recognized him based on his size, his hands, his voice, the words he used. He soothed their baby back to sleep in the midst of this attack. That alone, more than anything else, suggests that it was exactly who she said it was. Additionally, her identification of him was corroborated. Her very first act after he left was to go to the neighbor's house and call petitioner's apartment, where she spoke to their son. One would expect at 2:30 in the morning that if she had called over there and it wasn't him, that he would have been asleep in bed. Instead, he wasn't seen until minutes later, wide awake, wearing the same clothes as the attacker and sweating profusely, just as we know she had described the attacker had done. The immateriality, of course, goes to both of petitioner's claims. Additionally, there was no false testimony. The detective's testimony in this case and the California Court of Appeals rejection of the NAPU claim was also reasonable. Fingerprint evidence, as Your Honor mentioned, is important only to the point that it is that the context shows its importance. Where an attacker wears gloves, where the item is a common item that was taken from the victim's home and could have been touched by any number of people before the perpetrator touched it, that kind of context and the circumstances of this case show that the fingerprint evidence here was minimally probative at best. In short, this petitioner's claims fail at every turn. He had the evidence. It doesn't suggest his innocence. It doesn't show his testimony was false, and it wouldn't have changed anything. The fingerprint evidence is a red herring, and if there are no further questions, I would submit. Thank you.
Well, do either of my colleagues have additional questions for the Attorney General? Hearing none, then, Mr. Curry, we're going to give you 1 minute, and I know you're going to make brilliant use of it.
Thank you. Thank you for that faith. I'll start right off with the fact that the witness, the poor victim, totally recanted her in-court testimony, and that's in the record. Totally recanted it, and she had good reason in her declaration for the recantation and her anger at her husband. Okay, so that recantation, and all the trial judge said was, I don't believe it. He didn't call her in or anything. He said, it's not credible. Forget about it. I want to point out, so number two, the gloves, that's a red herring because the gloves were off. Number three, all you have to do, and I've done trial work, is convince one juror. Jurors love fingerprint evidence. They do. Anybody who's ever done any trial knows that. Jurors want science. And here was something that cast doubt that and affirmed, cast doubt on the prosecution's case. In fact, very much so.
Counsel, your minute has been used. We thank you for your additional argument. Do either of my colleagues have additional questions for Mr. Corey? Very well. We thank you both for your argument. And the case of Panola versus Koenig is submitted. And we wish you both a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.